for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. I didn't mean to play the poison idea yet. That was Dresden 45, Swiss bank account. Now, take a listen to this. Here's Ron Paul on MSNBC this morning. Great job.
How many times will I say that? Let's bring in right now a guy that has really taken at least the internet by storm. And Ron Paul, I dropped my son off at the University of Alabama this past week. There were homemade Ron Paul signs all over the place down there. And I'm seeing that more and more wherever I go in my hometown of Pensacola. You go and people are just, they are just making signs and sticking them up all over the place. This, I haven't seen a lot of presidential campaigns like that. And so let's talk to Ron Paul right now. Hey, how you doing, Congressman?
Doing fine, Joe. Thank you.
What's going on the campaign trail right now for you?
Well, we have to check with the leaders, and they're out there in the hinterland, and we have to ask them what they're doing these days.
Well, it looks like they're making a lot of signs in their garages and sticking them up on telephone poles across the country. I saw you at the straw poll. You just ignited that crowd out there, and it seems that every time you go on, even like Bill Maher, you have the strangest group of people supporting you. I mean, Bill Maher has a very liberal audience, and yet it seemed that there was a libertarian streak out there and wherever you go.
Well, you know, to me, that's the most interesting part and the most exciting part. A reporter told me the other day they were in Florida, and they came across a table of somebody that just set it up, and they asked them, well, there were three of them there, and they said, well, what do you represent? And one was a Republican, one was a Democrat, and one was an independent. So I think that's pretty neat because, as you know, I stick to the Constitution, and I think the Constitution brings people together rather than divisive. So to me, it's pretty exciting.
Well, and of course, it's not only that you have a libertarian message on the economic front, but also when it comes to the war in Iraq, you were one of the few Republicans that opposed that war. Are you finding that it's hard to bring mainstream Republicans over to your side because of that?
Less so every day. Because they know, somebody the other day said, well, I was always for it, but we've given them enough time and we're tired of it. So they're coming around. And of course, I approach it not from a left viewpoint. I talked about why don't we only go to war unless, you know, when we declare it and then win it. And so it's a conservative approach. And the old right conservative position was anti-war. I mean, that was the old Robert Taft position. So it's not so strange. Republicans should feel good about taking this position. Actually, George Bush won his first election. you know, with his position, a humble foreign policy, and that's what I'm talking about. So it is popular. It's just been these last several years, the atmosphere that's been stirred up, I think sometimes deliberately after 9/11, that people are supposed to be fearful, willing to give up their freedoms, willing to go to war. And I think they're tired of it because it's bankrupting the country, and I think I've tapped into that sentiment.
Well, shouldn't we be fearful after 9/11 that those attacks could happen again?
Yeah, but I don't think we should be so fearful that we give up our liberties and go to needless war. I mean, we should. The thing that we should have done was gone after Osama bin Laden, and we didn't do it. And when people realize he used to be our ally, they all of a sudden think, well, there's something wrong with our foreign policy. So I think we shouldn't be so fearful as to being aware of what's happening. And I think a lot of people are starting to realize that our interventions around the world does stir up hatred toward us, and that's just common sense. So I think they're coming around to realizing that.
You talked about a Robert Taft foreign policy, a more isolationist foreign policy, but didn't the attacks of September 11th change the rules of the game?
No, not really. That's sort of like saying, you know, something happens, changes it, you know, our 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, or changes the, truth doesn't change because something happens. No, I think that everything really remains the same, but we should become alert and understand, you know, what motivates suicide terrorism and then deal with it. But if you ignore that and go off and do the same thing that motivates suicide terrorism, the problem gets worse. There are more Al-Qaeda now than ever before. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now there are plenty and growing. So the chaos that we created there is actually made our problems much worse.
What do you think motivates suicide terrorists?
Well, Robert Pape wrote a book about this, and it's called Dying to Win, and he analyzes this in great detail more than any other individual. He says it's occupation, and it's not religion. Religion plays a part in it, but it's occupation. And you have to think of it as, how would we as Americans react if the Chinese were on our land here telling us to live like they do and that we had to obey their laws and their religion and impose their will on us? We'd be shooting them too. So it's occupation of foreign powers that makes that motivates people to commit suicide terrorism.
But we weren't occupying Iraq on September 11th, 2001, were we?
No, but Iraq didn't attack us.
The Saudis
attacked us.
Well, Osama bin Laden attacked us.
But we were in Saudi Arabia. We had a base on their holy land. We had been bombing Iraq, and we had been over there for dozens of years. And a lot of people had died because of our policies there.
Well, we had 10,000 troops in Saudi Arabia, but we've had troops in South Korea for, what, 50, 60 years? We've had troops in Germany. Does that justify the attack of American workers at the Twin Towers?
No, I didn't say it justified it. I just said it explains it. And it doesn't mean that every time you're there that it's going to do it. But when people are upset, other cultures do it too. In Sri Lanka, the same thing happens. It's not a Muslim. It isn't the Muslims that are doing the suicide terrorists.
Talk about the Republican Party's failure to curb spending and to balance the budget and to bring down the debt since Republicans have been running Washington, D.C. Of course, Democrats took over this past fall, and spending actually has remained just as bad, and earmarks are actually up, and the New York Times reports that Democrats are actually bragging about the earmarks that they're bringing home. But David Walker, who runs the General Accounting Office, talked about a couple weeks ago a meltdown, an economic meltdown that America's facing in the next 20, 30 years because of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the deficit, the debt, and says we're just doing absolutely nothing about it.
Well, it's the political situation because nobody can vote against the spending. I mean, just talking about this war, a lot of people don't want to lose. They don't want to give up. They don't want to change the foreign policy. We're spending up nearly $1 trillion overseas in foreign adventurism. You'd have to change that. But we'd have to change our attitude about welfareism. But it's not easily done. So they resort to spending, getting reelected, borrowing and taxing, and then the inflation, the fact that the Federal Reserve creates money and credit out of thin air to tide us over, just like they've done this week. The market pundits are saying that they're overextended. There's too many economic bubbles. The dollar is overextended. The market tries to correct that, and that means there's, you know, the natural tendency for a collapse or a deflation. But the Fed, what do? All they have, the only tool they have left is more inflation. Last week, they, you know, all the central banks pumped in like $500 billion of new money that they create out of thin air. So you can't solve the problem of inflation with inflation. You have to eventually have sound money. You have to have people live within their means, and you have to have a government that's designed for protection of liberty, not policing the world, and not runaway welfare. It's doomed to fail, and that's what Walker's telling us, and I agree with him, except it's going to be sooner than 30 years. I think you're starting to see it come unraveled right now.
All right, Ron Paul, congressman from Texas, thank you so much, presidential candidate. Let me tell you, Ron, a lot of people out there in the Republican primary trying to seize the mantle of Ronald Reagan, but when it comes to economic issues, you're the only guy out there that's really delivering the same message that Ronald Reagan delivered for 30 years. Thanks so much for being
with
us. Thank you,
Joe.
Greatly appreciate it. We'll be back.
And, of course, the difference there is that Ronald Reagan only talked about cutting the budget. When he left office in January of 1989, he left this country with a $4 trillion debt that had been just a couple of hundred billion when he took office, a few hundred billion, not even a trillion. Yeah, Ron Paul's just like Ronald Reagan, only as Lou Rockwell explained on the show the other day, when Ron was in Congress in the early 80s and Ronald Reagan would call and say, Ron, I need you to change your vote and vote for this gigantic budget that's going to put this country in debt and violate the Constitution in 5,000 ways, how Ron Paul would say, sorry, Mr. President, you know I'm a big fan, but I'm not changing my vote for you or for anybody else. So that's the difference. One was an actor, the other not. But yeah, what a great interview that was, huh? Morning Joe, Joe Scarborough, actually asking the right questions. It was pretty obvious, I think. You know, you guys can tell I try to play devil's advocate as much as I can, or sometimes I really am dumb. Sometimes I play dumb to try to get answers out of these people. You can tell Joe Scarborough had no idea. Like, well, what do you think causes suicide terrorism? Well, occupying people's countries is what causes suicide terrorism. And Scarborough says, but we weren't in Iraq on September 11th. And Ron Paul says, yeah, well, Iraq didn't attack us on September 11th, dude. It was Saudis. Our troops were in Saudi Arabia. Tens of thousands of them. At least a few thousand still are, although they try to pretend they're not. And, yeah, don't get confused that Osama bin Laden had moved to Afghanistan, dude. That was where he could be, that was where he had safe harbor. That was where he had an alliance with the state rather than a place where he was being hunted by it. But clearly, let's see, declaration of holy war against the Americans occupying the land of two holy places. That's the title of the thing. Huh. I wonder if we can, you know, maybe, just maybe read the first two or three paragraphs and find out the motivation of our enemy. It's only 2007. But a good thing Ron Paul's here. And he reminds, well, an audience that never heard it before in their entire life, that there's suicide bombing all the time in Sri Lanka. No Mohammed anywhere. No Islam anywhere in Sri Lanka. And they have the same problem. So get that straight. Here's some poison idea, and we'll be right back with Corbett Edge O'Meara.
stuck on this.
Young and dumb, choose a just fantasy. Push out of the academy. Find your music busters that waste your day. Unless you're paid off, then you look away. Do you think this corruption will ever stop? What makes a person want to be a cop? Ran a red light storm is not so much the guy. Do you like to see his children cry? The couple who can take it for a little ride, but get sucked off on the side. Sworn to serve and protect, we get to kill it. Fast wearing, fast spilling. Piss on the street, bust the guy. Do you like to see his children cry? Bastards who suck, child, face, they're dead. As you look back, what goes through your head? Some still call you pig. Some still call you pig. Young and dumb, truth and justice fantasy. Fresh out of the academy. Find the loser, box his head, face your day. Unless you pay off, then you look away. He burned a flag from the house and punched a guy. Do you like to see his children cry? Off a hook and take it for a little ride. Kiss the dog on the side. Back when you suck, a child, lays there dead. As you look back, what goes through your head?
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9, 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. And my guest today is a lawyer from Detroit. Figure all these bogus terrorism trials in the news. We ought to get up to date on what's going on. And I'm going back to the beginning, that first big sleeper cell Al-Qaeda case after September 11th. The four arrested in Detroit. And our guest is Corbett Edge O'Meara. He was a lawyer for a witness in the case of the Detroit Four. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Just fine.
Good, good. Glad to have you on here. And now, your client was or is a guy named Omar Shishani. Is that right?
Yeah. Omar Shishani was a guy who, in the weeks after, and the months after 9/11, had the misfortune of being engaged in a fraud where he was attempting to use bad checks to purchase soybean futures in Indonesia, which then he would, you know, make money on and be able to buy the bad checks back. And all he was a kind of common garden variety forger, but he had the misfortune of having an Arabic name. And when he was arrested at the airport trying to bring these checks back because they didn't work, and he was arrested in Detroit, he was branded a terrorist, and John Ashcroft went on TV and said that they had caught a terrorist who was attempting to smuggle funds out of the country to fund Al-Qaeda, when really it was just some guy who had some checks that somebody had whipped up on their computer who happened to have an Arabic name. And
that was the connection to Al-Qaeda, huh?
Well, no, he didn't have anything. They actually, at different times, accused him of being a Chechen general and a recruiter for the Chechen Islamic militia and things like that, which he wasn't. And that guy actually existed. The guy they were accusing him of being actually existed, and it wasn't Mr. Shishani, who was a who isn't even an Arab. He's a of Chechen descent, but he's a not even a Middle Easterner. And he, in any event, he ultimately, they, after branding him a terrorist, and they raided his house, and they, and a Treasury agent wrote on a calendar in his house something like "die Islamic scum" or something like that, and terrorizing his family. The government came to the conclusion that he in fact wasn't a terrorist and was just a guy who possessed some checks that somebody could have whipped up on their computer. And as a result of that, they were willing to let him get probation. But while he's awaiting, and he gets out of jail, and while he's awaiting his sentence of probation, this other trial is going on with these four people who were falsely accused of terrorism, all of whom have been completely exonerated of all terrorism charges now, and the U.S. attorney who's involved in that case is being investigated and prosecuted by a special prosecutor, not by the actual attorney general. But he'd shared a cell with the snitch, the liar, who was accusing these four guys in order to lessen his own sentence, who had manufactured this entire false story of terrorism for these four guys who were accused of terrorism.
Now, let me stop you right there for a second. First of all, where was this jail cell? And I thought I had read that they had cells next to each other and talked through the slums.
They were actually both in administrative segregation because they were terrorists, or they were Arabs, basically. But they were in administrative segregation in the Milan Detention Center, so they were next door to each other, across the hall from each other.
Like the local county there in Detroit?
No, well, Milan is a rural county where they have a federal detention facility.
I see.
It's about 50 miles from Detroit.
Okay.
And so Mimza, Yusuf Mimza, who was the snitch in the terrorism case, who manufactured the entire fake terrorism case with the help of, absolutely conscious complicity, I would believe, of the prosecutor who withheld evidence and you know, was acting as a tool of the Bush administration as they attempted to whip the country into a frenzy so that the war against Iraq would be justified, and make them believe that, you know, there's terrorists around every corner and we need to give up all of our civil liberties in order to fight these imaginary demons.
Let's get back to that. I want to ask you about Covertino and his relationship with the headquarters in D.C. and with the administration and so forth, and for that matter, about all the fear-mongering and liberty-taking, too. Let's make sure to get back to those questions later in the interview there.
Well, you know, and that is – and really, in terms of this 4 years later having any lasting meaning, as we recognize now what a horrible idea going into Iraq was, and how much we've destabilized that already very unstable region of the world, and how much more people hate America now than they ever did before, and how much we've suffered, how much we haven't accomplished the actual goals that we were supposedly seeking to accomplish by going into Iraq. People should look back on the absolutely bogus justifications and the bogus media events that were created in order to justify that. And this trial of these four non-terrorists and the persecution of Omar Shoshani, who is these guys, the four supposed terrorists, they all spent about 18 months to 2 years, I believe, incarcerated while they're trying to deal with these cases. It might have been a little bit less for some of them. Omar Shoshani wound up spending over 5 years in administrative segregation, not because he was a terrorist, but because he had the gall to cross the Croft and Bert Convertino and the George Bush in their effort to whip the country into a frenzy and paint, you know, any Arab they can find as a terrorist. I had clients at the time who I had a client who he drove a truck. And his brother-in-law, who his ex-wife had kidnapped the children, taken them to Yemen, his brother-in-law calls up, and he's involved in a custody dispute, his brother-in-law calls up the FBI and says, my brother-in-law, who I have a long history, if you'd want to just check at any court where I'm a part of this, I have a long history of animosity with this person, and I am engaged in a legal battle with him and him with my sister. He's a terrorist. 25 cars descend on this guy's truck. They go on TV labeling him a terrorist because they find maps in his truck. He's a truck driver. Of course he has maps. He's on the front page of the Detroit News, Detroit Free Press, national media, branding him a terrorist. There was no evidence whatsoever except for this brother-in-law's completely unsubstantiated statement. And I got his charges dismissed at the preliminary exam. But had I not done that, he would have sat in jail for 2 years awaiting charges while John Ashcroft gets to go on TV about catching terrorists that are there around every corner.
Right. Well, and I guess you're lucky that they didn't just abduct your client and turn him over to the Navy to be tortured.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they could have done that. He wasn't a United States citizen, and yeah, I suppose he could have been some sort of – and who knows how many people that's happened to. And he's a guy, he ran an ice cream shop. I mean, his family had an ice cream shop. He drove a truck. He was the least harm, the most harmless person that I've encountered in my life. And well, he had, you know.
I mean, I think it is important, and you brought this up a couple of times now, too, in terms of both of your clients, neither of whom had the slightest thing, I mean, never even mind the phony Detroit case, which we're working our way towards here, but your two clients, the witness in the Detroit case and this other guy with the truck driver, in both cases, you have the government going on TV and saying, oh, we know he's Al-Qaeda, we know he's a Chechen fighter, we know that this guy, you know, the purpose of his money, it was an Al-Qaeda connection, et cetera. And they're outright lying. I mean, if this is a local murder case or whatever, and the prosecutors go on TV and make all kinds of false assertions about the evidence against you before your trial starts, the judge will at least move you to the other part of the state or something, right?
Sure.
I mean, that's not fair. Shouldn't John Ashcroft, isn't that like in violation of the law or something for him to come out and make all these assertions when, and then it comes out later that they had absolutely no evidence of ties to Al-Qaeda or what have you?
Well, if I go and do that, if I go and say some guy walking down the street is a terrorist, he can sue me. And but you can't sue John Ashcroft. He's held to no, you know, there's no accountability at all for him. And you're right, he poisoned. I mean, because of these false allegations, which the government absolutely knew were untrue, by the time Omar Shoshani, the client with the check, shows up at the Bureau of Prisons to start serving his entirely unjust 72-month sentence for possessing these checks, where if he hadn't had the temerity to question the government's case, he probably would have gotten probation or a year in jail at the most. By the time he gets there, because of these totally unsubstantiated and totally uncorroborated and totally false allegations that he is a terrorist, the Bureau of Prisons believes it, and the Bureau of Prisons puts him in administrative segregation so that he spends a very large percentage of the time he spends in prison, he spends in the hole, locked down 23 hours a day, all by himself, never seeing another person.
Now, what do you call that again? Administrative segregation?
Administrative segregation.
That's isolation, basically, throwing you in the hole.
Yeah. It's to keep you away. It's to keep him from... I mean, they could say it's to protect him because he's a terrorist and other, and the loyal Americans in prison would hurt him, but he never had any problem when he was let out of it. He never had any problems with other inmates. It was entirely to punish him and to, you know, it's also to keep him from infecting and radicalizing all the other inmates there who are all going to become members of Al-Qaeda if people with Arabic names are allowed to walk around in the prisons. But, in any event, MIMSA tells him, Yusuf Mimza tells him that basically I'm full of crap. Yusuf Mimza says I'm full of crap. I'm just lying on these guys, these terrorists, to prove to help myself because I'm in trouble and I'm going to lie and everybody wants a terrorist, so I'm going to say these four guys are terrorists. Omar tells the government this, and the government, as a result of this, takes away his plea bargain and takes away his commitment to a lesser sentence as a result of his willingness to accept responsibility for his actions.
Okay, now.
And as a result of that, he gets 72 months in jail. He's actually out now. He's in Detroit. He's served, I think, about 48 months, and then he's some time in a halfway house. The people, and they refused to, he did actually testify at the trial, but some of the individuals were acquitted and the rest were exonerated after the trial. But he paid with, you know, 5 years of his life for, being willing to testify at that trial.
Wow. No.
And he's, you know, quite bitter about it. He did break the law. He's not, you know, the most sympathetic individual in the world, but if I, with the name Corbett Edge O'Mara and tail skin, decide I'm going to print up some checks on my computer and fly to Indonesia and try to cash them, I'm probably going to get probation. And he would have gotten that, even after the false allegations of terrorism, had he not crossed Bert Convertino, essentially. An individual who's now, who knows, he's suing the government too, and, who knows how vigorously they're actually going to pursue him because, who knows what he knows and who knows how far it goes, because he was, you know, deputized and authorized to engage in the activities that he engaged in by very high members of the Bush administration. He wasn't acting as a, I know the person who was U.S. attorney in Detroit at the time, and he quit shortly thereafter, and I think part of that was because his authority was usurped by the people in Washington who were doing things that he would not countenance.
Interesting. All right. Well, let me stop you there. We need to recap a little bit of this, and then I want to parse a little bit of it, too. I'm talking with Corbett Edge O'Meara. He's a lawyer from Detroit, and he represented a guy named Omar Shoshani, who was basically accused of some low-level document fraud, financial fraud, the kind of thing that, as you just heard him say, he or I would get probation for at most a year in jail or something like that. They accused him of being a terrorist for a long time before they finally got over that. And they made a plea agreement with him that they would give him a shortened amount of time if he would help point at other witnesses. Then while he's in jail, he shares he's on the same cell block in the cell next door with Yusuf Mimza, who is the star witness in the Detroit sleeper cell case. And while he's in jail there with Mimza tells him that he doesn't know whether these guys are terrorists or not, but he wants revenge against them because one of them at least had ripped him off in one of their fraud deals or something. And so he wanted revenge, and he told this guy, gave advice to my guest's client that, listen, just tell the FBI whatever they want to hear and you can get out of here. It's a great strategy. And so what happened, though, was when my guest's client, Omar Shoshani, attempted to tell the defense and the court that, hey, listen, your star witness in this other case admitted to me that he's completely full of it. Then they tried to, they screwed him out of his plea deal, which I don't know if that's illegal or not. I know that it should be. I know it sounds like criminal behavior there. So I want to get into the specifics of that, Mr. O'Meara, if I can here. In terms of the plea deal, I read now what they did was they added qualifications and said they wanted him to take a polygraph. Is that the same thing as actually, you know, revoking his plea deal, or is that just being sneaky and within the law?
He agreed to take a polygraph as to his cooperation in the check case. He was unwilling to take a polygraph as to his interaction with Yusuf Mimza, as a result of his unwillingness to, because the polygraph, I mean, it was Bert Convertino's polygraph, and it was going to be a interrogation where they sought to break him down and help their case.
Right.
That's the environment. He did not want to take it. I didn't think he had an obligation to take it. And as a result of not taking it, they revoked his plea bargain. That was the excuse they used to revoke his plea bargain.
I see.
And which had a cooperation reward built into it. And as a result of that, he didn't get a motion for downward departure, which would have allowed the judge to go below the sentencing guidelines at the time. As a result of that, the judge had to sentence within the sentencing guidelines. And even at the low end of the sentencing guidelines, he got 72 months in mm-hmm. prison, which required that he do about 5 years.
So you told your client, Omar Shoshani, that, hey, listen, if you insist on telling this story about their star witness being a liar, you're going to lose your plea deal. And he was willing and knowingly gave up his plea deal and did extra years in prison in order to tell the truth at the trial of the Detroit Four. Is that the case?
He felt he had an obligation to tell the truth and to not let these people be sent to prison for the rest of their life, which is what the government was attempting to do, regardless of the cost to him personally.
Did the jury, were they allowed to know the information that this guy was losing his plea deal by testifying? Because I read in the press that when he got up there and said this stuff, that they rolled their eyes and treated him like a chump. And here's this guy who's saying, fine, lock me up for 4 years for telling the truth then.
The jury was not made aware of that. And I actually, I have great respect for the attorneys who were involved in the terrorism trial. I would have handled the examination and cross-examination of Mr. Shoshani differently than they did.
Now, did you advise him, don't do this, keep your mouth shut, and get out of here?
I told him what the consequences would be. But I got to run. I'll get the stuff out of my car. I told him what the consequences would be, but I left the decision up to him. I told him that it was definitely. I told him you crossed the government in their most publicized prosecution of the year, if not the decade, it's going to have negative consequences for you. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever anticipated the consequences would be as significant. I was very surprised that Judge Edmonds, who was the judge in his case, let the government get away with what they did. And I think in retrospect, when she realized the sort of prosecutorial misconduct that had been involved in that case, she probably had some second thoughts about how she bought in hook, line, and sinker to Bert Convertino's theory of who Omar Shoshani was and how he should be dealt with.
And then,
probably has had some moments of, or ought to probably have had some moments of self-criticism over who she believed, because she definitely believed that Mr. Shoshani was a liar and was a terrorist and was withholding information, because that's what Bert Convertino told her.
Mm-hmm. And now,
and he intervened. He and the prosecutors in that case intervened in his sentencing with Judge Edmonds in order to ensure that he get a more significant penalty.
Oh, man. I'd like to say that this is all unbelievable, like something out of Kafka or whatever, but unfortunately it's completely believable. It sounds, you know, right out of the daily headlines, especially this week. This guy, the U.S. attorney, Eric Strauss, is that the guy that was a friend of yours? You knew him?
No, I trusted him. And I feel that he was circumvented by people. He ultimately became head of the anti-terrorism unit after Bert Convertino. When an anti-terrorism unit was formed, he became head of that after Bert Convertino was excised from the office. But at the time, he was definitely being controlled by – he's not the person making the decisions, and I think he made decisions – He was forced to take positions he would not have taken on his own as a result of people more powerful than him in the Attorney General's office influencing him. I trusted him, and actually I do trust him as still, but I believe that he was a tool that violated an agreement he had with Mr. Shoshani and was sold a bill of goods and took a position. I'm sure he was just following orders. But their orders, I'm sure he regrets at this time.
Mm-hmm. Now, the federal prosecutor in this case, Covertino, you're a lawyer. Is this guy not a criminal? I mean, it sounds like, besides just withholding evidence here and there.
He is certainly under criminal investigation. As I understand it, he is under criminal investigation at this time.
In my opinion, if
he knowingly withheld information in a capital case, that would certainly make him somebody who the law ought to inflict punishment upon.
Well, what about just his involvement in terms of you and your client and all to keep your client's testimony out of the courtroom?
It's bad to cross the man. He's the man, I think in my case they did what the law allowed them to do.
They were within the law.
Bad motives. And I think they did it in abrogation of their obligations to behave in an ethical manner and to put forth an honest case and prosecute people in an honest manner. And I don't know whether or not Bert Convertino or other members of the Attorney General's office knew that they were being misled and were intentionally misleading the American people, but whether or not they did it knowingly or willfully, blindly, they did it. And we suffer, and young men and women die every day as a result, in part, of the actions they took.
Yeah, well, I'd say I accept that premise, that this was a big part of Linus into war, even though there wasn't any kind of direct connection. It was part of that atmosphere of fear.
I'm very grateful that you gave me an opportunity to vent, because I don't get this opportunity very much anymore.
This was a period of my life where my life
seemed to make some sense in terms of how I practice law. But I actually need to go practice law at this moment. I'm very grateful that you had me on, and I'd be happy to talk to you again at some point.
Okay, great. Yeah, I probably will be calling back to follow up on a couple of these. Thank you very much for your time.
Keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks. Everybody, Corbett Edge O'Meara, the lawyer for Omar Shoshani. And there's more to that case. I didn't get a chance to ask him about Brahim Sidi, another defense witness who was deported. He was sent back to the old world before he could testify for the defense in the Detroit sleeper cell case. More on that case in the days and weeks to come. ST. Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. That was Suicidal Tendencies. Two wrongs don't make a right. Three rights make a left. But two wrongs do not make a right. Learn that lesson well. All right, so, yeah, this is Chaos Radio, 92.7, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And something the guest said there at the end really bothered me. It was when he said, "Thanks for giving me an opportunity to vent. I don't get a chance to very much about stuff like this." And I thought, my God, it must really suck to not have a radio show. What do you people do who don't have radio shows? My head would explode if I didn't have an opportunity to get up here and yell on this mic and know that there's other people listening on the other end of it and tell you, "Man, did you see this headline? Here's what I hate about it." If I couldn't do that, I don't know what would happen. Go ahead and lock me in, what is it, administrative segregation? The hole. Because I won't be safe, man, if I don't have this here pressure valve, which I appreciate you guys tuning into. Or else it wouldn't really be a show. It would just be a madman in a room yelling. And, yeah. That's not very good on a resume, you know? But now I feel really sorry for this guy. Corbett Edge O'Meara, not only does the government persecute all of his clients under the color of law, but he doesn't even have a radio show to go and bitch about it in front of everybody on. Jeez. That's got to be really hard on the psyche, man. Really. I don't know. For my part, I'm glad I have a radio show. I'm glad you guys are glad I do. Well, the few of you who are. I don't know. Hey, look at antiwar.com. That's where all the bad news in the world is. It's the best site. They got all the news from all the papers in the world, all the most important stuff, updated in real time, always, constantly. Christmas, Easter, Eric Garris's birthday, everything. Antiwar.com has all the bad news in the whole world. Go and look at it. And we run the propaganda pieces, too. When Michael R. Gordon says, oh, Iran's behind everything bad about what's going on in Iraq, when? Well, we run that, too. Because it's news itself that it's being run when an article like that runs in the Times. You know what I mean? It's its own news story. So, but yeah. And it's all, you know, you go to the top page, we got all the most important stuff. Top headline as of right now, I guess I need to hit refresh. Top headline as of right now, helicopter crash in Iraq kills 14 GIs. And a lot more bad news beyond that. But, you know, down at the bottom of the page, we have it all divided up by region and country and so forth. Iran, Iraq occupation, Lebanon, Palestine, Israel, the war at home. War on Terror, Middle East. Of course, there's this new CIA 9/11 report by the Inspector General. So we have our own little section of the report and two or three stories about that. I guess a story about it and tenet statement. Somalia, Sudan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Africa, South Asia, Russia, Americas. All the news that's that you can fit on a web page. Which is, you know, all of it. Antiwar.com. My blog is Stress, thestressblog.com. Stop by there and, you know, say stuff in the comment section if you want. ScottHortonShow.com is where I keep the archives of all the interviews, including the whole thing of the Corbett Edge O'Meara interview, which you may have just missed. Will be up there in the archives here before too long. And about 300 other interviews beyond that. Somewhere around there. I haven't really counted in a long time, but it was 200 and something about 8 months ago, and I've been doing, you know, on average, I guess, 4 or 5 interviews a week ever since then. So, yeah. Lots. 300-something, 400-something, I don't know. Probably 300-something. And then also, let me point you to LibertyStickers.com. Help support this show. Go to libertystickers.com, the Scott Horton section. I got 75 new stickers, 80 new stickers, because I keep making them up and keep sending them on. I got 80-something new stickers in the Scott Horton Show section. So if you've been there before and you thought, ah, that's funny, but I'm not going to give him my money for that because it's not that funny, well, go back, because now there's 80 more stickers in there, including some great Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani stickers and of course, anti-Iran war propaganda for the back of your car. All kinds of great stuff like that. So check out the Scott Horton section at libertystickers.com. And that's it for websites for me to talk about, I think. One thing that was brought up in the Ron Paul interview on MSNBC that I played for you there at the top of the hour was the question of earmarks. And this is the closest thing to anything that they have on Ron Paul, and it's nothing. And what they try to say is, oh, look at Ron Paul, you know, getting all this money for his constituents and so forth. Well, Ron Paul votes against every appropriations bill and encourages and gives speeches and tells the rest of, you know, his fellow congressmen that they ought to all vote no on it, too. And then when it passes anyway, he does what he can to get as much of that money as he can for people in his district. Because the money is going to be spent anyway. And if he does not, as a member of Congress, their representative down there in District 14, if he doesn't get them their share of that appropriations of their tax money back in the form of the warfare welfare state and what have you, then it's up to the bureaucrats and the unitary executive to decide which counties and which districts and which congressmen get federal dollars basically to bribe their constituents with. And Ron Paul has said consistently for 30-something years that the problem is in the appropriation of money. The problem is in the unconstitutional nature of every appropriations bill passed. in that it provides funding. They provide funding for every unconstitutional government agency and a million kinds of pork that have no provision in the Constitution whatsoever. The problem is not we need campaign finance reform, because it's not fair that Lockheed gets to bankroll Giuliani and Romney. The problem is that if Lockheed bankrolls Romney and Giuliani, they can give the payback big time with our money once they get power. And I remember years and years ago hearing anecdotes about how the lobbyists just don't even bother Ron Paul anymore. The lobbyists on Capitol Hill, man, they're in and out of every congressman's office all day long, wining them and dining them and buying them steaks and convincing them to do this and that. But they don't even bother. They might bother Ron if they want him to help them stop something. I guess maybe then they'll drop by. But the lobbies, they don't even try to bribe Ron Paul, because they know that he is going to tell them, no matter what they come to pitch to him, he's going to say, I'm sorry, that's outside of my authority. I don't have the right to spend the American people's tax money on that. So, you know, good luck to you. Bye. And they don't even bother anymore. It's like Lou Rockwell said about him. Newt Gingrich got all the Republicans together in the 1990s on this one particular massive appropriations bill and said, all right, everybody, now listen, you all have to vote for this. And anybody who doesn't vote for this is going to face severe consequences. Grr. Except for Ron Paul, because, you know, what are you going to do? He's exempted from the we'll take revenge on you, because we don't have the slightest expectation he'll vote for this thing. Forget it. They don't even bother with him anymore. And why? It's partly, you know, obviously it's because he's principled and will do the same thing every time. But what's the principle? The principle is that if it's not in the Constitution, it's not Congress's damned business. And so therefore, sorry, it's just like Harry Brown running for president. People said, In 1996, I saw him on C-SPAN. They said, well, what's your position on abortion, Mr. Harry Brown? And he goes, well, I'm running for president, and you might notice in Article 2 that it doesn't say anything about me making abortion decisions for anybody. So, you know, people or states or otherwise. So I'm not even going to answer your question, because I'm not going to do anything one way or another about it, because it's not within my power. That was the Harry Brown answer, and that's what Ron Paul says on 99% of these things. It's not within my authority. And that's why Lockheed won't bankroll his campaign. That's why it's up to people like you and people like me. And by the way, if you missed the Ron Paul clip at the top of the hour, it's on the blog at lourockwell.com. That's where I found it. And it's a YouTube of Ron Paul on Morning Joe this morning with Joe Scarborough on MSNBC. And it's a great interview. And Scarborough's fair to him. They were friendly when Scarborough was in the Congress, so he doesn't treat him like a chump, but he asks all the best stupid questions. And Ron Paul gets to say, well, you see, you know, the real answer is this. And of course, Ron Paul gets it right on all of it. And they're talking about foreign policy. What motivates suicide terrorism? It's great stuff. It's on the blog at lourockwell.com right now, so check that out. All right. I'm just going to goof off, man. I'm going to play some music for you guys, and then I'm going to spend the next hour ranting and raving about how much I hate the President of the United States. I wish that he would, you know, commit harikari like Japanese. I guess he would have to have honor to do that. But I'm going to talk about how much I hate the President of the United States, which is a lot. I'll try to come up with, you know, some ways to quantify it for you. And why? Of course, Iraq policy. More than anything else. Well, that and destroy my Bill of Rights. But that's not the topic for the next hour. The topic for the next hour is how much I hate the President and why Iraq. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And more ST.
We'll be right back. fighting the last war. We have to be preparing to fight the new war.
Anti-war radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
We'll be right back. the ghost of Tom Jones.
All right, folks, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm here every day from 11 to 1 Texas time doing the bad news for you. And I'm going to see if I can get some of this audio for you here, if I can pull this from Bush's speech today at the Veterans of Foreign Wars. You know, funny aside about the Veterans of Foreign Wars, if you put on your thinking cap, you might remember in August of 2002, Dick Cheney gave a speech to the Veterans of Foreign Wars. And he lied his ass off, man. And all of his accusations about Iraq, particularly that they were reconstituting nuclear weapons, were all laid out. And then what happened was George Tenet told the guys at the CIA, hey, make what Dick Cheney said in that speech true, even though none of it was. And that was the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq from October 2002. This is September, I forget. That they used to buffalo the Congress, intimidate the Congress into authorizing the war, which, of course, they have no power to authorize wars. They have power to declare one or not. That pesky old Constitution again. And, you know, I'm not a constitutionalist. I'm over it. I read Lysander Spooner. How could I be a constitutionalist after reading Lysander Spooner, man? However, at least the theory goes, not that I buy it, that there's this social contract whereby we, the people in this society, allow this government to exist as long as it stays confined to the written charter that created its power. That's the contract. And they have, you know, we supposedly give them all this authority over our lives. With the handshake, with the bargain, with the signed on the dotted line by the founders, I promise, they said, this government is to be bound by the words of the contract. And that means if the Constitution creates the Congress in Article 1 and creates the President in Article 2 and creates the Supreme Court in Article 3, and that's where they derive their authority from, well, then that also means that everything else in there that says what they can't do also applies. That's how it's supposed to work. So it's not that, you know, I pray to George Washington like some idol. It's a contract. And it says, well, for example, if the country is going to go to war, the responsibility is on the lawmakers in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. Not up to King George and his National Security Council and their whims. That would be, you know, the constitutional answer. And I think Ron Paul is right that so many of the problems that of this society, this entire society, that derive from, well, first of all, so many of these problems that we do have, in fact, derive from the national government's intervention in the lives of the people of this country and everybody else in the world. And secondly, that the vast majority of those things which are so destructive, which our national government does, are unconstitutional. And if we could just hold them to their contract, all demagoguing it aside, we the people and isn't it pretty and all that. It's a contract. If we can hold them to that, we'd be a hell of a lot better off. You know, you want to turn Oregon into a socialist state, fine. Just, you know, that's what federalism's for. Leave me out of it. Of course, I'll live in fascist Texas and have to flee to, you know, I don't know, the free state up there in New Hampshire? I don't know. Veterans of Foreign Wars. Dick Cheney gave that speech. George Tenet told the CIA, make it seem true. And that's when the Congress authorized the war. One of the things that Dick Cheney said in that was that Hussein Kamel, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, defected and admitted that they kept weapons after the end of the first Gulf War and lied to inspectors. And this is the veterans of foreign wars. These are the guys who fought in World War II, Korea, Vietnam. These are the guys who were going to be sending their sons under Dick Cheney's care to go and wage wars in the Middle East. And he lied right to their faces with that shit. Because he left out the rest of the sentence, which was, Hussein Kamel also said and proved with the documents and by, you know, later inspectors going to the sites and verifying that, yes, it was true. Saddam Hussein kept some chemical weapons after the end of the first Gulf War and lied to the inspectors. And then about 6 months later said, nope, forget that, and ordered Hussein Kamel himself to oversee the destruction of all of those chemical weapons. And that every last bit of it had been destroyed in 1991. That's what Hussein Kamel said. That Iraq had no weapons at all. And Dick Cheney went to the veterans of foreign wars, the guys who fought in the other wars and who were sending their sons to this one. And he went and told them, yeah, Hussein Kamel admitted that they kept their weapons. A damned lie, and he knew it was a lie. Now here's Bush latching on to this preposterous talking point that the problem with the Vietnam War is that America finally gave it up and left. I mean, talk about just turning history on its head. The problem with the Vietnam War is that we should have stayed and killed them all. 3 million wasn't enough. 3 million Vietnamese who refused to submit to American colonialism, who were obliterated from the face of the earth, wasn't enough. We should have stayed and killed millions more to prevent what? To prevent the communists from killing some too. Let me see if I can get this video to play for you. I don't want to just quote from the president. I want to hear it from him. See if he can even get through it.
Do you have a dandruff shampoo to control curls?
Oh, man.
Or for sensitive scalp?
You made me listen to a commercial first, you jerks. That's what happens when you pull up video live on the radio. Chaos Radio, Head and Shoulders shampoo, really good for them flakes. Let's see if they'll play this footage now.
President Bush is tending to relations today with Canada and Mexico, and as often is the case, the subject, though, turned to Iraq and the embattled government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Let's go to our White House correspondent, Suzanne Malveaux. She's traveling with the president up in Canada. The president was pretty open about discussing the Iraqi prime minister today when it came to that news conference.
Wolf, you're absolutely right. The Hurricane Dean had an impact as far as here in Canada at the so-called Summit of the Three Amigos. One of those amigos, the president of Mexico, Felipe Calderon, had to leave early to deal with the hurricane's aftermath. President Bush offering U.S. assistance. But as you know, the big news that was made today was on Iraq.
It was a rare moment of candor. President Bush publicly criticized the Iraqi government for not making the political progress he had hoped as more U.S. troops worked to secure the country.
I think there's a certain level of frustration with the leadership in general, inability to work, to come together to get, for example, an oil revenue law passed or provincial elections.
The president was asked about the state of Iraq at a North American summit with the leaders of neighboring Canada and Mexico.
There's a new pulse that can give you a dentist clean feeling. New Pulsar Pro.
Oh, man. Dead air, huh? Talking into a goddamn dead microphone. I'm a really crappy radio host. Apologize. Hopefully this is the clip.
President Bush is tending to relations today with Canada and Mexico.
No,
and
this is the same thing. All right, they got me going to the wrong... They got me to something from yesterday. All right, well, anyway, here's the Agence France-Presse. And I guess they released the speech, so this is all written about what Bush is going to say today, which apparently he's already said, but CNN can't get their clips with the right titles on them. U.S. President George W. Bush, in a speech on Wednesday, will warn that U.S. withdrawal from Iraq could produce a catastrophe similar to what occurred in Southeast Asia after U.S. forces left Vietnam. According to experts, from Bush's address released in advance on Tuesday, the U.S. president was to charge that an early exit from Iraq would pull the rug out from under U.S. troops, just as their efforts are paying off. Bush's speech ties anti-war forces in the Vietnam era to the hundreds of thousands of people killed in the aftermath of the U.S. pullout, and hints at a parallel disaster in Iraq if U.S. forces leave too soon. God, you know, the contempt revealed by the president here that he holds for all of us is just staggering, isn't it? I mean, talk about your hateful, cynical, manipulative crap. Hell, I'll just go out there and tell him, if you're anti-war, it's your fault about all those boat people. It's your fault about the genocide in Cambodia. I don't know if it's really a genocide, the mass slaughter in Cambodia. Oh yeah, that's your fault for being against American intervention in Southeast Asia. Yeah, those are not consequences of America intervening and attempting to colonize a people in a jungle who would not be colonized. And then retreating, defeated. No, they were about to win in Vietnam, I swear they were. I know that George Bush is dumb as hell. I know that the guy, you know, is probably qualified to mop a floor somewhere. But I believe that he knows he's lying when he says this. When he goes out and tries to say that the people who finally got sick of 15 years of war in Southeast Asia, that it was their fault that everything didn't go well. And who among us is buying this stuff? How much do you have to hate yourself in order to say, well, gee, I guess if the president wants me to believe that that Vietnam War was about to be won in 1975, if only, you know, they had surged some troops in there or whatever, I guess I'll go with that. No, it's not Eisenhower or Truman and Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon's fault. It's not their Department of Defense's fault. It's not their State Department's fault. It's not the government of the United States' fault for promising the French we'd help back them up in their colonies in Asia. And then inheriting, attempting to inherit that empire from them. I'm so mad. I wish I got this audio, although I'd be even madder if I actually heard the president sputtering this stuff. Many argued, oh, I love that, many. Oh, really, huh? Where's your hyperlink there, boss? Many argued that if we just pulled out of Vietnam, there would be no consequence for the Vietnamese people. The world would just learn how costly. Jesus, I'm worse than the president, listen to me. The world would learn just how costly these misimpressions would be. In Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge began a murderous rule in which hundreds of thousands of Cambodians died by starvation, torture, or execution. In Vietnam, former American allies, government workers, intellectuals, and businessmen were sent off to prison camps where tens of thousands perished. Tens of thousands, he says. Hundreds of thousands more fled the country on rickety boats, many of them going to their graves in the South China Sea, said Bush, who pleaded for patience with the U.S.-led security crackdown in Iraq. U.S. troops in Iraq are carrying out a surge as helping bring former Sunni insurgents into the fight against Al-Qaeda, clearing the terrorists out of population centers, and giving families in liberated Iraqi cities their first look at a decent and normal life.
Oh, man.
As they take the initiative from the enemy, they have a question. Will their elected leaders in Washington pull the rug out from under them just as they are gaining momentum and changing the dynamic on the ground in Iraq? He said. My answer is clear. We will support our troops. We will support our commanders. We will give them everything they need to succeed, said Bush, who linked the painful U.S. defeat in Vietnam to the situation in Iraq. 3 decades later, There is a legitimate debate about how we got into the Vietnam War and how we left, Bush said. Whatever your position in that debate, one unmistakable legacy. Unmistakable, says George Bush, who does not make mistakes. One unmistakable legacy of Vietnam is that the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens whose agonies would add to our vocabulary new terms like boat people, re-education camps, and killing fields, he said. Isn't that funny? How many times have you heard peace activists denounced by the war party for making Vietnam analogies about Iraq? This is a quagmire. We're fighting to prop up a government that the people don't want. You can't have a counterinsurgency among people who just hate you more and more and more every day and expect that somehow you're going to win them over and everything's going to be great. We're destabilizing the whole region and, you know, creating all new, a whole new future for the Middle East with this mess. Oh, you hate Bush. You just hate George Bush. No, really, look, man, you look at Vietnam and you look at Iraq, there's some parallels here, you know? Let me list, you just hate George Bush. Well, of course I hate George Bush. He's a bloody-handed fascist butcher. He's the worst president since Franklin Roosevelt. Worse than Nixon. Easy. He is the slayer of near a million people in Iraq, at least, you know, indirectly, responsible for the deaths of nearly a million people from that war. He's a guy that, you know, took the Zippo to the American Bill of Rights, to our whole Constitution, the entire separation of powers. Of course I hate George Bush. But that's not why I'm complaining. That's not why I'm comparing Iraq to Vietnam. But now Bush wants to say, oh no, there's only one lesson about Vietnam that can be applied to Iraq, and it's a damn lie. It's the idea that the problem, God, how shallow and stupid do you have to be to listen to the president say these things and believe him and accept his argument? That the problem with the Vietnam War was that it ever ended. That it finally ended. How could that be? That anyone would accept that argument. And yeah, it's true. There are people in South Vietnam who died. The people who were our, you know, loyal puppets. And, you know, the people who lived under them. Communists won. That's what happens when you lose a war. And then he says, oh, Cambodia. Yeah, we'd have prevented all the deaths in Cambodia. But of course, it was America's secret war in Laos and Cambodia that created the danger of the Khmer Rouge. I mean, they existed, but they were nobodies. They're a bunch of crazies running around in the forest hurting no one. And hated the Vietnamese communists, too. But it was when American bombers killed them by the millions, and they saw that those same bombers, well, at least, whatever, tens or hundreds of thousands, I don't know what the casualties were from the American bombing in Cambodia, a lot. And then when they saw those bombers being the same planes that also bombed the VC, they made friends with the VC. They put their differences aside because they had a common enemy, and so the VC gave them a bunch of AK-47s and taught them how to use them. And I think the way I remember it, at least, it's been a while. It was right around that time Pol Pot got back from, you know, studying Rousseau and Mao Zedong in Europe. And came back and said, great, I have an entire army of crazies with AK-47s. Let's march on Phnom Penh. It was because of Richard Nixon that that happened. That was the fault of American policy. And now what, George Bush is saying, what, that Gerald Ford would have gone in there and intervened against Pol Pot? Check the record. America backed the Khmer Rouge, at least at certain points. I wish I had better footnotes. I shouldn't even said that without a bunch of footnotes. But I think my friend Anthony Gregory has written about it at lourockwell.com, for one. But yeah, I don't know that story good enough to have repeated that one. But in any case, the fact of the matter is, millions of Vietnamese, 3 million Vietnamese, were killed in the American war there. In Laos and Cambodia, I don't even know. The consequences for the people of the region, disastrous from, you know, the day Truman made a deal with the French and all the way through. It was nothing but one continuous catastrophe. Of course, escalating under Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon to terrible degrees. But what was the point of winning the Vietnam War? Don't you remember, I mean, if you're my age or younger, you know, I remember being kind of confused about the Vietnam War when you were a little kid. Well, World War II, that makes enough sense, right? Hitler was going to conquer the world and we'd all be speaking German right now and all that, right? Okay, that makes sense. But Vietnam, what were they going to do? Take us over or something? Why would we have a war there? Oh, the doctrine of containment and this and that and complicated domino theories and all that. Yeah, about that. The domino theory. That's not what happened. In fact, Nixon, after he lost the Vietnam War, went and shook hands with Mao Zedong and said, eh, you know what? I don't care if you're the dominant power in South Asia. Let's be friends. And Mao said, okay. There's your terrible dominoes of world communism taking over everything. And as Ron Paul points out endlessly, we're friends with Vietnam now, with the communist evil Ho Chi Minh government that defeated American forces in the south of that country. We're friends. We have investments. We trade with them. And from the propaganda I've read, at least, you're talking about at least among the people who are left, an incredible amount of forgiveness. I don't know how really widespread that is, but I guess I've read or seen on TV on half a dozen or a dozen maybe different occasions of Vietnamese people going, yeah, that was a hell of a war, wasn't it? Well, sit down. Let's eat, you know? I'm lucky for that. The Arabs ain't gonna forgive us like that. But anyway, so here's George Bush. The unspoken premise, the underlying assumption of his statement here to the veterans of foreign wars, again, jerking these guys around who've given up the most in terms of lives and limbs and family members for America's foreign policy. The underlying premise is, look, I completely destroyed this place, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. I'd like to begin today's speech, veterans, today, by explaining what's normally the unspoken premise. I have completely and totally destroyed that country. Everything is a complete disaster, and it's so bad that I think it's plausible that I'll be able to get away with telling you that it'll get even worse if we don't stabilize the place, etc., and make it better. And this is, of course, here it is. Man, it's August 2007. This is the same argument we've heard all this time, is we can't leave until we make it better first. That's all it is. The very same argument. With the admission that this entire thing is a disaster. And now, does George Bush take any responsibility for that? Does he ever explain his unspoken premise of what he's done, the responsibility that's on his hands for the deaths of so many people? Oh no, it'll be just like when Pol Pot was in Cambodia and genocide, and yeah. Please. And even if that is true, even if that is true, let's say America leaves and the proxy war in Iraq goes completely crazy and becomes a full-scale war between, you know, I don't know, Egypt and Saudi Arabia versus Iran and Syria or something. I don't know. Then still, whose fault is that? My fault? For saying we ought to end this occupation, we ought to stop stealing money from Americans and spending it killing people over there? that at some point people have to recognize that there is no, it's going to be better one day, and then that day we can start to leave? The disaster's my fault for opposing this thing in the first place? For being right about it all along? And insisting that it comes to an end? At least our involvement in it comes to an end? Or, now, you know, pardon me for trying to be realistic here, is the responsibility not on the people who waged the war? And the people who supported the invasion in the first place? All you people with your yellow ribbons and your American flags. All your goofy belief systems that have you think that George Bush can go from being a complete fucktard to being some great Caesar who's going to, you know, save America. Because, of course, that's what Caesars do, is save things, right? Rather than destroy them, right? Isn't it your fault for supporting the war? Isn't it George Bush and Dick Cheney and Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz's fault? Isn't it Hillary Clinton's fault and John Edwards' fault? Tom Daschle's fault? Isn't it, well, I guess actually Pelosi opposed the war. I don't know how much she did to put pressure on others. Isn't it the fault of the Congress and the president and the people who work for him in this administration? Particularly all those guys in the White House Iraq group who sold this war? Mary Madeline and Andrew Card and Karl Rove. And Scooter Libby, and the president and vice president, George Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. Isn't it their fault, if we even believe what the president says is true, that if a withdrawal is to take place of American forces, that somehow everything, by definition, will get much, 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 much worse? Are we really to believe that's the fault of the people who opposed the war rather than the fault of the people who invaded it? We gotta, all the people whose fault it is that we're in this mess, we have to defer to their judgment, which says that we can't ever leave until everything's fine, which it'll never be as long as we're there. Is that really where we're at? Is it really arguments that shallow that win the day? Hi, I'm George Bush, and I'm here to tell you that one day things will be alright, and then we can leave then, maybe. But as long as things are bad, we can't. Does that work? Oh, yeah. Hey, we're using the Sunnis in the fight against Al-Qaeda. No. The Sunnis who were working with Al-Qaeda to fight against Americans had a problem. Well, I guess the better way to say that would be the Al-Qaeda guys who were a tiny percentage of the insurgency anyway and who had an alliance with the Sunni-based insurgency who were fighting, they have blowback problems of their own. Their tactics were too extreme and too many civilians died and people got pissed off. And so the local Iraqis, who have always been the dominant force in the insurgency despite the propaganda over the years, they got sick of it, and they've been fighting, and I've been reporting to you on these airwaves that there have been fights between the local Sunni insurgent types and Al-Qaeda, at least for the last couple of years, and particularly in the last 6 and 9 months. And then our government gets to take all the credit for that? Just because our guys are now showing up and giving them guns and bombs and money and saying, hey, Sunni insurgency, we're friends now. Now General Petraeus gets to take the credit for saving Al-Anbar province because the locals decided that their alliance with the jihadist suicide bomber types wasn't really paying off the way that they had hoped. And does that in any way indicate that the Sunni population of Iraq is ready to go ahead and live under a Maliki government? Clearly not. Has General Petraeus himself said a dozen times in front of reporters with cameras and pens and microphones and recording devices that there is no military solution in Iraq? Ultimately, it's a political one. Hasn't he said that over and over again? And what does that mean? It's a political one. Somehow force the people of Iraq to submit to the rule of the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, the Iran parties. That's the solution, the political solution that they've been trying to force up until this point. But now we have the redirection. And in fact, I'd recommend to you Justin Raimondo's article on antiwar.com today. It's called Support the Troops. Bring them home. They want to come home. We ought to do what they say as far as that goes. But he talks about the redirection and the fact that American policymakers have been convinced, I think undisputably, by the Israel lobby. There's really nobody else to convince them of this. Certainly not true, and it's certainly not in anybody else's interest to convince them of this, that Iran is the enemy, that the crazy Ayatollahs are the big threat. And, of course, the Saudis and the rest of the American puppet dictatorships, the Sunni Arab dictatorships in the region, they're worried too. And so America's George Bush's phony democracy that they created in Iraq, which just elected the Iran parties and gave them this power that, as I was just saying, Bush has been backing all this time, the U.S. has been backing all this time, the Iran factions. Well, now they got to fix that. Oops, we imported the Iranian Revolution that Dad Bush and Ronald Reagan spent so much money paying Saddam Hussein to contain and keep in Iran. And now Junior has imported it to Iraq. And so now we got to do something about that, say the policymakers. And of course, one of the problems with antiwar.com is we're always so far ahead of the curve that sometimes we're years ahead of the curve. Policies that are floated that you can tell are going to be the way they have to go eventually get put off. You know, we all talked about the redirection, so to speak, not calling it that, because, of course, that's from Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker from last fall. But we talked about, I think Justin called it the Biddle's Pivot, after a guy named Biddle who wrote an article in Foreign Affairs saying it's time to start using befriending the Sunni insurgency and the former Baathists and using them as a trump card against the Iranians we've accidentally empowered and so forth. Khalilzad, of course, in the early part of 2005, was urging bringing the former Baathists and local Sunni leaders and religious groups and so forth and bring them into the government en masse and basically switching sides. Hey, there's another parallel to Vietnam, huh? A little coup d'etat. Was it 1 week or something before Kennedy was shot in the head? He had Diem shot in the head and replaced by his competition, the other family competing in for power in South Vietnam. Was it a week before or 3 weeks before or something? Anyway, and now it looks like they're finally getting to it. The redirection, Biddle's pivot, Khalilzad's plan. It's time to go ahead and reinstall the Baathists. A good friend of mine, David, who I'm so glad to hear his nephew is back from Iraq, at least for a little while. Hope he'll not have to go back at all. But my friend David, he emailed me one time and said, listen, I mean, what do we got here in Iraq? The policy supposedly is to create a strong central government that will, you know, do what Houston wants with the oil price, you know, go along with OPEC on the oil, that will fight Al-Qaeda, that will limit the influence of Iran. They'll keep the Kurds from, you know, thinking that they're free and trying to break away and create their own state. We'll be allies with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and at least not overtly hostile toward Israel. Well, there's only one group of people in Iraq who will do all of those things. The Baathists. The guys that we did the regime change against. The guys that got fired down to the elementary school janitor. You know, groundskeeper Willie had to be a Baath Party member to have a job in Iraq. And he got fired, too. All of them. Those are the only ones who will do all the things that the American policymakers supposedly want. Please don't anyone mistake my rant for, you know, I'm saying do this. Although, if you are an imperialist, it's the logical thing. You know, you prop up the majority. That's okay for a while, but they don't really need you. If you want to be a colonialist and an imperialist, you have to prop up the minority and use them to lord over everybody else. Which is how it was under Saddam Hussein and the Baathists and the king before that. Wasn't it the king before the Baathists? Maybe there's one other party in between there. But, yeah, that's how you do it. You prop up the minority, which in a way is what has been happening, because we're propping up the minority within the Shiite majority. And that's, of course, the Iran parties, the Dawa party, and the Supreme Islamic Council. But, in any case, seems like maybe the stab in the back is now moving. It makes sense. Particularly in light of the fact that Dick Cheney wakes up every morning trying to figure out a way to start a war against Iran. And as I've warned on this show, and as the guests that I've brought on to talk about this subject have warned, including military strategist William S. Lind, and a lot of these other guys too, our troops are in major danger. If Dick Cheney bombs Iran, there is a strong possibility or likelihood or one of those words that the Shia Arab population that is dominant in southern Iraq would finally say, that's it. Which they haven't. For the most part, the Shiite population has been sitting out of the insurgency. The Sadr guys defend themselves. But, are not primarily the aggressors. Although, I don't know, landmines isn't quite self-defense. That's a booby trap, but what are you going to do? It's their country. But for the most part, the Shia population has gone along. The Ayatollah Sistani has said, hey, listen, everybody be cool. The Americans eventually will leave, and, you know, we'll make sure that we have near total control of Baghdad. And, We'll be in the catbird seat, so they haven't really been fighting this whole time. But if Dick Cheney bombs Iran, you could very well see the Ayatollahs and all the religious leaders on the Shia Arab side saying, all right, that's it. Everybody grab your AK and shoot the nearest American. As many of them as you can. And in that case, our guys could be in deep, deep trouble, because the majority, my understanding, the vast majority, really, of the Iraqi army, quote-unquote, are not just Shia Arabs, but are actually members of the Badr Corps, which is basically the private religious and you know, paramilitary force of the Supreme Islamic Council, which was created by the Ayatollah, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution. They just changed their name a few weeks back, actually. But, as William Lind quoted in the American Conservative, Abdulaziz Hakim, who is, I guess he's dying of cancer now. His son's supposedly taken up the mantle of the scary party. I guess I need to read more about that. But Abdulaziz Hakim was quoted as saying by a British journalist, and this is in the American Conservative magazine in the article How to Lose a War, when asked what would the Badr Corps do if Dick Cheney bombed Iran, he said, we would do our duty. Which means they would exercise their loyalty to Iran by fighting Americans in Iraq. And of course, Muqtada al-Sadr has threatened the same thing numerous times, in fact. So picture a map of Iraq in your head, and picture Baghdad somewhere more or less right around the center of it there. And now draw a line straight to the southwest, only curvy and wiggly. Down there toward southwest, is that what I said? I'm sorry, toward the southeast. And draw that line down there to Kuwait, to the Persian Gulf. That's our troop supply lines. That's almost entirely Shia territory, controlled by the political gangs of the Supreme Islamic Council, the Dawah Party, the Mahdi Army, and of course a few others too. But that place is likely to go up like a candle, as an intelligence source said to Seymour Hersh, in the event of war with Iran. So switching to the Sunnis makes sense. Trying to get our guys safe behind Sunni lines, if you can call them that. That's right, the terrorists, the dead-enders, the terrible, evil people who've been defending themselves against foreign occupation this whole time. Now they're the good guys. And now it does seem, and I don't mean to read too much into current events the way they're playing out, but it does seem very much that we are on the path of this redirection now. In Iraq, not just around the rest of the Arab world, but in Iraq. It's time now, according to John Warner and Carl Levin in the Imperial Senate, to stab Maliki in the back and throw the Dawah Party out of power. Just at the time that Iyad Alawi is proposing that the government be replaced, that there be a coup d'etat, and not too subtly suggesting that he, the former interim prime minister, so-called, be made the new dictator of Iraq. And he is, of course, a secular Shiite Baathist type, and has some bridges to the Sunni community and so forth. He's not one of the Supreme Islamic Council types. And so that's looking more and more likely, that we're going to have a Vietnam DM-style coup d'etat in Iraq. And at least it would make sense, you know, if you're an imperialist. It's sort of logical, I guess, right, to try to switch sides back to the Baathists before bombing Iran. I don't know. I can understand how, you know, on the stupidest right-wing war party talk radio shows, you know, where they just repeat the GOP talking points all day or whatever, I can see how there's some part of the population that could hear an argument that the problem with Vietnam was that we just didn't kill enough of them and we finally gave up, rather than the problem was we intervened. The politicians and criminals who control the American government intervened where they had no business whatsoever, cold-bloodedly murdered about 3 million people, in effect. Now, I know some of our guys were shooting back in firefights and so forth, but whose land were they trespassing on? To the deaths of 3 million people. I mean, if I told you, hey, Germany killed 3 million people in this country or that country, you would go, those Nazi bastards, right? It's not all right to kill millions of people, is it? No, it's not. Even if it's America. Even if Superman did it, it would still be wrong. And, of course, the supreme irony of all this Cold War policy is that after the defeat in Vietnam, when the American people and even, believe it or not, the American Congress and the American military were over it and were licking their wounds and, you know, trying to get their act together again and ceased containing the Soviet Union. That's what destroyed it. Ha ha, wow, to think that a fourth grader with a fourth grade education could tell you that all empires fall. And if the real menace of the Soviet Union is them taking over the world, well, we ought to let them take over as much of it as they think they can and not intervene at all. Makes me think if there'd been no Truman Doctrine, we just let the Soviet Union think they could get away with expanding endlessly, maybe the whole Soviet menace would have been done by the end of the 1950s. Of course, once America stopped containing them, well, hell, maybe it would have taken into the 60s. But once America in the 70s stopped containing the Soviet Union, and in fact encouraged them and lured them, as admitted to by, you know, the CIA guys and including the National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski and others, initiating covert action in Afghanistan to lure the Soviet Union into invading that puppet country of theirs outright in order to prop up its communist government there. And for that matter, them being obligated to give millions and millions of dollars to all the revolutionary movements in South America, in Africa, They went bankrupt because America finally stopped containing them and let them. Oh, you want to export your world revolution, huh? Yeah, good luck with that, pal. That's what destroyed the Soviet Union. We let them be. Place fell apart. And, you know, it's funny. They talk about Afghanistan. Yeah, it was time for us to give Russia their own Vietnam. Like, there was a realization back then that, you know, no land wars in Asia, dude. We really screwed up in Vietnam by having that war. We're not going to do that anymore. But, hey, let's you know, run this little covert action and prop up Osama bin Laden and his buddies and have them fight a holy war against the Russians. Give them some Stinger missiles and just see just how many helicopters those Soviet Ruskies think they can produce at, you know, a reasonable price. And we'll give them their own Vietnam. And now look at us here, just, you know, 10 years later, 12, 13 years later, we're in there going, yeah, come on, guys. Let's do exactly what we sneakily lured the Russians into doing in order to destroy them. But we'll be immune from all its consequences. Yay, America. Yeah, there's nothing in history that suggests that when empires go and try to conquer South Asia that they go bankrupt and collapse, right? Yeah, no empire ever destroyed itself trying to conquer Asia, have they? Nah. I don't know. Nope, the lesson of Vietnam is that we should still be there killing gooks to this day. That's right. The lesson of Vietnam is to stay in there and keep killing them until they're all dead. Then that way, we can feel pride. And because they look and speak a little bit different, we'll just tell each other that, you know, they're not humans, but some bad name that we think of for them to deny them their humanity and make it okay to kill them in mass. I don't know. I wonder, the majority of the people, not that any mass numbers listening to this, but the majority of the people out there, when the president says that the problem with Vietnam was that the anti-war protesters finally got their way and ended American intervention there, finally, and that that was the problem, does the majority buy that? Do any of you buy that? Would the majority agree with me that that's a bunch of horse shit? That America should have never intervened in Vietnam? And the problem with our withdrawal is that it happened in 1974 and 75 instead of, you know, 1955 or 45. I wonder. I guess if they just repeat it a few times. It used to be that, I mean, there's always been a strain of American right-wing idiots who believe that, right? What we should have done is just drop nuclear bombs on them all, drop chemical weapons on them all, burned all of North Vietnam to the ground and killed them all. Then we would have won. There's always been a strain on the American genocidal right-wing who believe that. But is that becoming the majority view? Can they just say that on TV and radio over and over and make that true in the mind of the American people? Oh, yeah, we had a big problem in Vietnam. What we should have done is dropped hydrogen bombs on them all. Instead, those peaceniks had their way, and some people got killed. Man, that's strange. Hey, something that I haven't given any attention at all, really, on this show at least. I mean, I've given a little attention reading about it, but I don't think I've covered this at all on the show, is the North American Union and the proposal to basically merge all three powers in North America together, America, Canada, and Mexico. And I guess there's a debate over whether this is American, you know, right-wing nationalist imperialism conquering Canada and Mexico, or whether this is the evil commie socialist New World Order selling out and destroying America, or both. What does Congress have to say about it? What's the plan? How's it going to work? Will Americans spend Ameros, or will they just say forget you and create their own currencies? I guess they'll do what they're told, won't they? How much longer left for Canada? How much longer left for Mexico? And see, here's my thing. I'm not against immigration. I'm for open borders. The problem is I'm not for opening the border by pushing it all the way down to Panama or Guatemala. I guess we probably keep going past Guatemala, right? I'm not for pushing the border of the state further north and further south and giving DC's tyranny even more control over people. I'm for the border as it exists at the bottom of Texas, and at least in terms of keeping the Mexican government out and presumably keeping the American government out of their country. I'm for that. But of course, I'm also for free trade and free travel of labor. I mean, you people want a free market, don't you? You're not communists or fascists, are you? If you're going to let capital go all around without tariffs, you got to let the labor force go. You can't free up your market in this way, this way, and this way, but then regulate the hell out of it this way, this way, and that way. Only causes problems and distortions and so forth. I don't have a problem with Mexicans coming into this country. I don't have a problem with a wide open door and everybody come on in. I don't give a damn. In fact, if you're smuggling pot, even better. Driving down prices in my neighborhood, and I appreciate it. But North American Union, I'll tell you a little anecdote in lieu of having any facts on the North American Union to educate you about. 10 years ago, 1997, I saw Mikhail Gorbachev give a speech at George Washington University. And man, you should have seen all those grad students just lined up to give old Mikhail a hand job, man. It was horrible. At George Washington University. But anyway, so he gives a speech. He goes, look, come on. All the world leaders know we're headed toward world federalism. We have to have one army, one peace force. We can't have all these competing empires and wars. We're going to get everybody killed. We got to have some form of world federalism. And he said, look, we're not sure how we'll get it done either. We're all agreed on our central premise pretty much. But it may be that because of right-wing reactionary types who refuse to give up their old ways and so forth, we might have to move toward continental union first. Move toward pushing the nation states as they exist into larger and larger continental organizations and regional organizations. And then move more and more to integrate those. And you know, it's the hard road to world order. Paraphrase Richard Gardner. But we'll get there one day. And that's what's going on with this so-called NAFTA and free trade area of the Americas and eventual North American Union that they're pushing for here. Although I should note, because this is really a major victory for those reactionary types, the free trade area of the Americas was supposed to be a done deal by 2005. And it's basically dead. Best I can tell, the South American nations are not going along with the free trade area of the Americas. And so instead, what are you going to do? Conditions change, things change. And so, we'll focus on integrating Canada, the United States, and Mexico together. And we'll use the same excuse, right, that they used to create the EU, which is we need it to be able to compete against America. You know, always the fallacy of these collectivist terms, right? It's us Europeans against them Americans, and you got to work to make our GDP the same number as theirs or better or what have you. And now it's the same thing. Let's turn it right back around again. Hey, listen, got to stay competitive. But of course, you can have free trade with Mexico and Canada. You can have open borders with Mexico and Canada. All you need is one piece of paper that says, hey, let's not keep each other's private citizens out. Or prohibit trade across these lines. Sign here, sign here. That's simple. In fact, they don't even need to do that, right? All they need to do is just repeal all the tariffs and restrictions. And just get rid of them all. You don't even need to sign a one-line contract to have free trade and free travel with Canada and Mexico. Don't even need a one-line treaty. All you need to do is not pass laws that create the opposite. And so anyway, I'd like to see the Constitution overthrown. But I'd like to see it replaced with the Articles of Confederation. And then eventually I'd like to see the states peacefully secede from the Union. And then ultimately I'd like to see those states dissolve and live in a land of liberty and private property. But, you know, in the meantime, let's not conquer Mexico and Canada. And let's not have them conquer us either. Let's not do the conquering thing anymore in North America. I think we can be friends with our neighbors without forcing them to join under our system of government. And frankly, I don't think that the American system of government is going to continue to have its form in any way near what your grandpa left you. I guess you'd have to go back quite a way to get to the form of the American government as it's supposed to be. But yeah, we go ahead and start really integrating Canada and Mexico into the American federal system. You can basically just forget about it and just call it the North American Empire. Kiss your Bill of Rights goodbye. See, that's what ought to be what's the decent part of conservatism, right? Whoa, let's not just go throw our Bill of Rights in the trash, right? Didn't we mean to keep that? Yeah. Let's conserve the Bill of Rights, guys. How about that? Let's conserve the form of our government from the Constitution, where the president's not a dictator and the 10th Amendment reigns supreme. Not that it ever has, but still. Okay, I'm done babbling. That's it. Anti-War Radio. Tune in here tomorrow if you want. 11 to 1 a.m. p.m. 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Radio Chaos 92.7, 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Wasted Youth or Motorhead? Motorhead. Ugh.